Boy, are you feeling
unethical? You trying to embarrass me in front of my family?
Well, it is unethical. I can't.
Oh, boy, you are really something. What the fuck do you think this is? Sunday school?
No, Roy, but this is...
This is gastric juices churning. This is enzymes and acids. This is intestinal is what this is. Bowel movement and blood red meat. This is politics, Joe. This is the game of being alive. And you think you're what? You think you're above that?
I think because he did have this kind of oppositional personality, he did like to challenge the establishment, kind of like take people on. There was almost this daring quality to the flimsiness of Cohn's closet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking the 1950s. This Roman holiday with David Shine, this, you know, beautiful, tall, blonde man who kind of did seem to be Cohn's type. I mean, my jaw just dropped, right? Because it did seem like if you wanted to be discreet, as you're persecuting communists and homosexuals, like if you didn't want this to come back to you in a certain way, you just wouldn't have behaved that way. And it is kind of just a bit shocking how much Cohn almost dared people to call him out, which they did when the fallout from this gallivanting with Shine crashed down upon him.
Hello, I'm Adrian Dobb.
And I'm Moira Donegan.
And whether we like it or not, we're in bed with the right.
So welcome, listeners. This is a very special episode. I've been really looking forward to it because like a lot of, you know, sensitive souls, maybe especially like a lot of people who grew up Catholic, I have long harbored this like secret fear that morally speaking, I am just like the biggest piece of shit in the world, right? Like, I am this like especially contemptuous person. No, I think this is like actually a very formative like intellectual exercise. However, when we were researching this episode, I was completely disabused of that notion because I learned that I cannot be the worst person in the world because that title belongs to Roy Cohn.
Yeah, that seems fair.
We probably should have done an episode on Roy Cohn a long time ago. There are a few figures in the history of like gender conservatism or interestingly gendered conservatism who I've been a little bit afraid to tackle on the podcast just because their influence is so vast. You know, I'm thinking of like Freud, Phyllis Schlafly, St. Paul. These are all like kind of mega people who I know we're going to have to talk about one day, but who I've been afraid to dig into. But today we're going to finally harpoon one of these white whales because we're talking about a big one, the lawyer, the fixer, the famous anti-communist, the Trump mentor, crook, closeted gay man, and the model for a very interesting form of dominance masculinity.
That's right. So we have a wonderful guest for this today.
Yeah, we do.
Matt Sittman.
I've been waiting to break in here.
the host of the amazing podcast, Know Your Enemy, and the obvious person to ask about a Roy Cohn episode.
Why is that, Adrian? After Moira's wind up and saying he's the worst person in the world, you say, and the person who first came to mind to talk about this horrible person is Matt Sittman.
Well, I feel like you and Sam have blazed a trail when it comes to treating awful people with compassion on your podcast. And again, like I think Moira's right that like compared to someone like Whittaker Chambers, who seems to have been like overall sort of decent, Roy Cohn just really truly a piece of shit. And so I think that we need your compassion and your empathy with this person. But also, you know, you and I share with Cohn the fact that, you know, we are gay men, although, as we were saying, of a very different generation. And in confronting him and his hypocrisies, you know, which are sort of legion and very easy to look up if you have HBO and can get your hands on Angels in America just about anywhere, you know, they're very different. But there are pangs of recognition of things that we sort of observe around us now. So, yeah, I that's all I meant. I'm not saying you're a bad person, but I'm saying you're a...
I'm giving you a hard time.
This would feel incomplete without you.
Well, thank you.
We should say we've all sort of done a lot of delving. We've become coneheads, if I dare say so. we've all become coneheads in a different way. There are a slew of amazing documentaries about Roy Cohn. There are a bunch of interesting books. There are a bunch of good academic books that sort of combine him with a bunch of these gay mentor figures that Moira already alluded to. So I think that we're all going to come at this guy in a slightly different way. And you already mentioned, Matt, that Citizen Cohn, the sort of most exhaustive book.
And exhausting to read.
Exactly. It's also exhausting to read. We, if anything, we have too much information on this guy, which probably means that, you know, we'll sort of have to take sort of stabs at him and try to sort of figure out how to make him fit into broader narratives, because there's just like it's an over-documented life and it's a really complicated life.
Yes. Believe it or not, listening to Moira's description of Cohn being someone that you've hesitated to take on the podcast because he's just, there's too much, kind of as you were just alluding to, right? He's a towering figure for those of us who, you know, labor in these vineyards of trying to understand these freaks on the right. And that was the same for me. Like, I think I knew Cohn would fascinate me too much. And so he was a figure I hadn't fully explored up to this point. And I must say, since you mentioned the empathy Sam and I try to bring on Know Your Enemy to some of the people we talk about, the topics we raise, one thing I did do, and you mentioned the various documentaries about Cohn, which are very good, a number of them. Like, there's more than one very good documentary about Roy Cohn. So there's lots of footage of him in those documentaries. But also, preparing for this, I would just kind of look up interviews with Cohn on YouTube. Because I do feel like seeing someone kind of live like that is important to getting a read on them. And I found him evil, yes, wicked, but also it's kind of like the allure of evil. He was kind of fascinating to watch.
He had a lot of charisma.
Okay, I'm glad I'm not alone in that judgment, because the specific clip, maybe your listeners will want to look it up, that really impressed me in precisely that way was he was in the late 70s on this show with Gore Vidal, because this television movie called Tail Gunner Joe about Joe McCarthy had just come out and they were sparring over it. Now, there's other things that are said in that interview we can talk about later, but I just was watching and I thought, my God, this guy's holding his own with Gore Vidal, who's so handsome and suave and good on television, articulate. You know, Gore was like the best at that. And Cohn kind of held his own debating Joe McCarthy with him.
I have the same intensity of feeling about the destruction of a person and a period in American history, which destruction I think has been very unfairly attempted in Tail Gunner Joe.
Okay, in summary of your being here today, first, Gora, your PR people did know about the appearance today with Roy Cohn. And
I just knew he was going to be on a program a couple of days ago.
And they even switched
different
from Wednesday
reading
to
that
Thursday.
There's going to be a debate.
Well, you know, page six in the Post, they make everything into a fight. I mean, that's what happens. But I do appreciate you both coming.
I'm glad it went so smoothly.
What are your reactions to each other, in summary, of your few minutes spent?
Well, if you overlook Mr. Vidal's McCarthyism, he's a very charming person.
Roy Cohn has managed to stay out of jail all these years, and I admire him for that, and I'd like to have him for my lawyer.
I will conclude on that point.
And I thought, this guy had real chops. I kind of see how he could persuade people or work on people or get them to do his bidding in a certain way. He was really charismatic.
Yeah, you know, I think like right now we're in a moment in our current conservative climate where we see a lot of evil that is impulsive, a lot of evil that is boorish, a lot of like id-driven evil, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stupid evil. And Roy Cohn reminds me of this like 20th century vision of evil that is calculating and intelligent and has this ability to manipulate that almost requires a degree of understanding of others, right?
Mm-hmm.
He is an evil that turns his very real capacities and virtues towards a like politically malignant and like amoral project, right?
Uh-huh.
As opposed to the evil we have now, which feels a lot more like a temper tantrum by a toddler.
At the same time, there is a kind of continuity too, right? Like, especially around the Rosenberg trial, there's every indication that he exaggerated what he did, right?
Mm-hmm.
He does present as a heel, right? He does have this kind of heel evil that like his, at this point, most famous associate, Donald Trump, would kind of perfect in some way, I would say, right? Like, he's the guy you're supposed to boo and jeer when he walks onto the stage. And he kind of inhabits that with a kind of relish. Uh-huh. Like, there is a kind of Vince McMahon quality. I mean, very, very different. But, like, he's magnetically bad and commands a stage in a way that feels very much of our moment. This guy is a great troll. He would have made an amazing troll.
Yes, definitely. And I'm sure most people listening to this know that Cohn was a kind of mentor and lawyer for Donald Trump in the kind of 70s and 80s, almost a mentor to Trump. That basic fact now is, you know, well-reported and well-known. But I think this foray into Cohn's life and times really impressed upon me that he wasn't just like Trump's lawyer. He wasn't just like a guy who did some favors for Trump. I really see him as kind of initiating Trump into, or being the kind of midwife into kind of who Trump became politically and ideologically.
Yeah.
Trump was relatively, I mean, he had his instincts, he was Trump, but relatively unformed when they first met and when Cohn took on, you know, this case of the Trump, their apartment buildings, right, discriminating against African-Americans, you know, from renting the apartments. And it wasn't just like Cohn helped them get out of that, or, you know, Cohn was Trump's consigliere in that particular case. It was really, yeah, like, this guy was a mentor to Trump, and I think bears a lot of blame for who Trump became.
So with that all in mind, this man's talent, his charisma, his sort of self-styled legend, and his impact on, you know, the conservative of our own age, let's dig into it. Let's go through the life of Mr. Roy Cohn.
Let's do it.
Okay. So a lot of, I think, people of our generation, the sort of like millennials, first came to know Cohn after he died through really Angels in America, the Tony Kushner epic about the AIDS crisis in New York, in which Cohn is a central figure. He is called in that work the pole star of human evil. And he is sort of a symbol there of the rapacious indifference of AIDS, right? Like, how it comes after gay men, even when they are, you know, not members or do not understand themselves as part of this, like, righteous, oppressed minority, right? But more recently, he's come in for this secondary reappraisal as a mentor of Donald Trump. But I think it makes a little bit of sense to just start at the beginning with Cohn's childhood, which was, on the one hand, very privileged and also, like, very, very unhappy. Uh-huh. So he was born in the Bronx in February of 1927, and he was the only son of a marriage that is basically universally described as loveless between the mother, who was the daughter of a very powerful, very wealthy New York banking family, the Marcuses, and the man who they sort of corralled into marrying their quite ugly daughter in exchange for making him a judge, right? Uh-huh. So he is completely doted upon by his mother, but in some, like, weird ways. Like, both him and his mother had the same, like, big nose, and his mother tried to get what seems like an early nose job for Roy when he was still a child that got botched.
Oh, wow, really?
Which is, like, why he had that scar on his nose, which is, like, very visible and prominent.
I assumed he was a boxer, but okay.
No, it was like this mother was trying to spare him from what she had suffered, the ill effects of her looks, right? That was the way that his mom expressed love. He would live with his mother pretty much continuously until her death, which happened when he was 40. They were very, very close.
Yes.
And she was kind of a piece of work. Did you guys ever hear the Passover story in your travels through Roy Cohn?
No.
So a childhood Passover at Roy Cohn's house, the whole family, the big Marcus powerful cousins are all assembled. And as is typical of Passovers, you know, the youngest child, one of Roy's baby cousins, gets up and asks the four questions, which begin with, why is this night different from all other nights? And Roy Cohn's mother, who in recounting of the story that I've heard sounds like she was a little bit drunk, sort of bursts out laughing and she goes, this night is different from all other nights because the maid is dead in the kitchen. And indeed, the maid had dropped dead in the kitchen. She had had some sort of like heart attack or stroke or something. And Roy Cohn's mother, to preserve the Passover and not disturb the dinner that she was hosting, had the maid's body shoved under the table in the kitchen and was just going to like wait till dinner was over to deal with it.
Wow.
So that was mom.
Yes. Can I hop in here with a detail about Roy's mother?
Yeah.
I mean, you're right, Moira, to point out that they lived together until she died when Roy was 40. At which point, I think one of his aunts, her sister, moved in, actually. Oh. So he still had the maternal, you know, kind of presence there.
Was her name Agatha? Because that's, like, perfectly out of, like, the worst Oscar Wilde play ever.
But, Moira, as you pointed out, she was supposedly quite homely. And, you know, kind of the sister that they had trouble marrying off, despite all the money the family had. Adrian, the book you mentioned by Nicholas von Hoffman, Citizen Cohn, The Life and Times of Roy Cohn, that's the main biography I read. So I'm going to draw from it here. But, you know, going forward, I wanted to mention that. But this was what a Cohn family member said about the mother. And this is a quote. Dora, that was her name, Dora. Dora was never institutionalized, but in my opinion, she should have been. She was demented. She was an extremely neurotic woman. Whether she was psychotic or not, I'm not sure, although I suspect she probably was. Dora was not well educated. She did not go to college. She was not a very intelligent woman, but she was a domineering woman, extremely neurotic, the type that had to dominate everything she had any contact with. And that part of the von Hoffman biography, Citizen Cohn, part two, it's called Mama's Boy. So if we want to get into any of the Freudian, analyses here, the overbearing mother was a striking aspect of Cohn's biography.
That's amazing.
Isn't that an incredible quote?
I know. I had the thought, I was driving down here this morning and I was like, you know, I'm so glad we have Matt for this, but I think there's going to be moments when I wish we had Sam. Because I think the Freud is going to jump out.
Yes.
Now, our producer, Mark Yoshizumi, points out that we never plug the Patreon on the main feed episodes anymore. So here's me plugging the Patreon on the main feed episode. So we have a Patreon. That's it. There are three tier levels. You get a lot of cool extra stuff, extra episodes. You get access to our Discord. I should also mention that we have a merch store. It's at TeePublic, and you can get a bunch of stuff with our logos on it. Mugs, your hoodies, your t-shirts, I think baseball jerseys or what they're called. It's cool. So you should check that out. And all that makes it possible for us to continue doing what we're doing. Something that you're going to notice going forward if you haven't perused many of these wonderful documentaries and books about Cohn, dear listener, you'll notice something that Matt sort of just casually dropped, which is that, you know, normally when you interview someone for a documentary about a person, that person will sort of try to may cushion what they're going to say a little bit. That does not on the whole appear to be the case with Roy Cohn in that HBO documentary, Bully, Coward, Victim. Like, there are at least three people who are like, oh yeah, he was the worst person in the world. The idea that like this family was just like, you know, the worst is something that like everyone seems to have been able to agree with.
And he was an only child, we should say. And it's funny when Moira mentioned the Seder, I wasn't sure exactly where you're going because one thing that is another kind of, you know, everyone says about Cohn's childhood is that because his mother kind of favored him like this and because he was kind of doted upon and treated as like a, you know, precocious young man, and because also, you know, his father, Al Cohn, ended up becoming a judge. He was kind of part of the Democratic machine, right? And that's why he married Nora for the money, basically, because you had to sort of pay tribute, you know, to the local machine to become a judge. It meant lots of like interesting political figures from the city, you know, would come to their dinner table. And Cohn was, he never liked to like sit at the kids' table or not be included. He would love to sit at the adults' table, listen, and sometimes hold court himself. But just to, in terms of how he was raised, that like, you know, your only son you put at the dinner table with these luminaries from the Democratic Party and let him hold forth. It's just, I think, a glimpse of, you know, how he was raised.
Did anybody come across the story from his childhood when he was 10 and he met FDR?
Yes, yes, that's in Citizen Cone. But go ahead, Moira.
Well, he meets at one of these parties that Matt is talking about, where his parents are hosting these Democratic Party luminaries. FDR comes and has dinner at the Cone family household, and a 10-year-old Roy Cohn tells FDR that he approves of his plan to pack the court. He goes, "That's smart. You should really do that." to which I wonder what FDR says. Yeah. So thank you, little boy.
Yes.
But yeah, that's he was never exactly a child, right? This is a guy who was in a rush to power almost from the time he was born.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's basically a teenager when he bursts onto the public stage. The other thing to point out is, of course, that so Cohn, right, comes from great privilege, and you know, we're going to talk about him as a conservative, but essentially comes out of a Democratic establishment, I think. And like it's interesting to think about his path then, right? Like Horace Mann, Columbia BA, Columbia law degree, with someone like, you know, another Know Your Enemy fave, you know, someone like Irving Kristol, right? Uh-huh. Brooklyn Boys, City College of New York, right? Like Cohn is taking a different route. He's taking the route that kind of was only opening up to, you know, Jewish Americans like at the time when they were extremely privileged, it seems to me.
Uh-huh. And, you know, part of the privilege, the money we've mentioned his mother's side having was like the Lionel Train Company, right? Toy Train Company was part of the money. The founder of Q-tips, the inventor of that, was part of the family money, but also the Bank of the United States, which in 1930, right, there was a run on the bank. And long story short, Cohn's uncle, the only banker, I think, jailed for their bank going under, even though he was seemingly an upright man who kind of the reason the bank got started was the family was so trusted. When they were in like the garment industry, you know, decades earlier, people would ask him to keep their money. But he kind of got caught holding the bag. There was a run on the bank, and he went to jail at Sing Sing, right?
Yeah.
And Cohn would visit him, right, in jail. And I would say of all the facts about Cohn's childhood, in addition to the overbearing mother, this uncle who had been jailed, like Cohn viewed his uncle being put in that position as like, what happens when you're on the wrong side of power?
Yeah.
It taught him, he made a vow to himself to never be kind of find himself in the position his uncle was in and kind of use power to, well, frankly, you know, it's telling, it's an incredible kind of, you know, the cunning of history. Sing Sing, where he visited his uncle in jail, was where the Rosenbergs would be executed.
That's right.
However many decades later, the same prison. So that experience of visiting his uncle in jail at Sing Sing was formative for him. And that's something kind of most of the documentaries and biographies really, I think rightly, point to as something that really shaped young Roy Cohn.
Yeah. In the Bully Coward Victim documentary, one of his nephews, actually, one of Cohn's nephews, proposes basically that he was so traumatized by this uncle going to jail.
I think it's a cousin, not a nephew. Sorry, Adrian. Being a little pedantic, I think it's David Marcus, who later became a journalist, a maternal cousin.
Marcus, that's right. Yeah, sorry. But yeah, so I think they propose basically that this is about a kind of an identification with the aggressor here, right? That like the only way to fight this is to join the carceral system. As Matt is saying, the very institution that jailed my uncle, I will work towards killing my enemies, basically, right? Like, it's a full-on identification with the aggressor. They don't say it. I think the cousins don't say it. But there is an element of, like, he must have been aware that, like, one way to end up in jail is being a gay man at that time, right? So, like, it's not that he's thinking, oh, I guess the lesson here is don't do financial scams, which... Spoiler alert, he would definitely do some financial scams.
He definitely did not take that lesson from his uncle's incarceration. Right. He definitely...
But I think the lesson he took away from the way I am exposes me to this kind of thing. So the only way to make sure it doesn't happen to me is to wield the power of that institution.
Uh-huh.
Something that the family really understood as well, you know, what would have been impressed on Roy Cohn was not only the risks of homosexuality, but the risks of being Jewish. Something that the family really understood was that the Bank of the United States was not unique in terms of its financial malfeasance around the time of the stock market crash. It was unique in that it was controlled by a Jewish family, right?
Right,
and, you know, Matt mentions that Cohn's uncle was the only banker to go to jail for that crisis, and the family really interpreted their uncle's misfortune as a product of anti-Semitism as much as a product of his own misbehavior.
Yes. I think at one point in the Citizen Cone biography, someone's quoted from the family as, yes, the Episcopalian Morgan or, you know, more establishment types, they could have fixed this. They could have covered the run on the bank, but they didn't because they were anti-Semites.
Yeah. And I think that might be a good way to transition to the Rosenberg trial.
Yeah.
Because Adrian, as you mentioned, Cone sort of like rams his way through his education. You know, Horace Mann, Columbia University, Columbia Law. He graduates from Columbia Law at 20, right?
Before he can even be admitted to the bar.
Right. Crazy. He gets admitted to the bar on his 21st birthday, which is the first moment that he's legally possible, right? And he pretty quickly gets recruited as a prosecutor for the trial of Julius and S.L. Rosenberg, in part because the prosecution was worried that the trial was going to look anti-Semitic, right? So they wanted a Jewish prosecutor, and that's part of how Cone got the job.
On the mere technicality that it probably was.
Yeah.
They're like, oh no, how could our anti-Semitic show trial, you know, be read as somehow anti-Semitic?
Do you guys want to give us a gloss on the Rosenbergs really quickly for our listeners who might not be totally familiar? Julius and Ethel.
So Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, the only two people executed during the Red Scare of the early 50s, and Cone would take ample credit for that, were basically accused of, in what, 1950, I believe, of having given the Soviets the secrets to the bomb. They were convicted in 1951 of espionage and were executed in 1953. They would have both been in their mid-30s at the time, and as Matt said, at Sing Sing prison in Ossining, New York.
So they were a married couple. I believe they were both American-born, but they were descendants of this group of Jewish, like Russian and Eastern European emigres who formed a like strong Jewish community on New York City's Lower East Side, right? And they were indeed members of the Communist Party,
That's right.
A lot of Jews on the Lower East Side in the 1930s and 40s were. Julius Rosenberg had served in the U.S. Army, and he spoke about his commitment both to the United States and to communism as sort of this like fusion that was much more typical, like during and immediately after World War II, of like a popular front fusionism, right? He's like, I am a communist and I am an American because these are the forces that defeated Nazism.
That's right.
And that was like something that you would hear from a lot of American communist Jews at the time. And they were like kind of like workaday people, right? They weren't very elite. Julius had an engineering job and some old army connections by which he does indeed seem to have been funneling some technical aspects of America's military development to the Soviets. So like in terms of like, were they actual spies? It seems pretty firmly established in the historical record that Julius Rosenberg like was, yes, a spy for the Soviet Union. Ethel's involvement is a lot murkier. And the choice to prosecute her as well as her husband, and specifically the choice to seek the death penalty for either of them, but particularly for Ethel, was something that was really Roy Cohn's pet project.
Yes. When the Venona papers, right, were kind of released and decoded after the Cold War ended, like it was pretty much confirmed, as you say, that Julius was in some sense a spy passing along information, even if, you know, kind of how important he was to the overall operation might not be certain. But Ethel, she didn't have a code name. Right. So she's not in these papers. And the fact that she was executed, too, was because of Cone's obsession with it. And it really seems like maybe this was Cone's chance to kill his mother, so to speak, to offer that analysis, because he was like really obsessed with her. And like, really, it was him who really, really, really seemed to want her to be executed as well.
And he did this according to his own autobiography, which Adrian, you said is like not the most reliable narration. But he did this at age 23 through a series of really illegal and wildly immoral gestures. So one of the first things he did was he persuaded Ethel's brother, David Greenglass, to lie under oath about the extent of Ethel's involvement in the espionage scheme. And he also had ex parte conversations, sort of like outside secret conversations, which are illegal, with the judge, Irving Kaufman, in which he persuaded the judge to pursue the death penalty, even though the Department of Justice and the FBI were both trying to avoid the death penalty, which they thought would have like bad PR effects. It was Cohn, at least in Cohn's telling, who both fabricated this evidence and convinced the judge to pursue the maximum punishment. So Cohn is at least presenting himself really as the Rosenbergs' murderer. He's like, I am the one who got these people killed.
Yes. Can I read something from the Citizen Cohn biography about his posture towards Ethel Rosenberg?
Yeah.
Again, this is from Citizen Cohn, Nicholas von Hoffman's biography. Between the husband and the wife in the Rosenberg family, Roy blamed Ethel the most. He was almost ferocious when her name came up, although the FBI memo relating the ex parte contact with the judge has Roy saying that sparing her life would be the best way to get her to peach on her comrades. Elsewhere, it almost seemed he would have commuted the father's sentence while showing no mercy for the mother. Roy spoke of her, quote, den mother supervision of the family's part in the communist movement.
And I mean, we should say that by contrast, I think J. Edgar Hoover initially pushed for a arrest of Ethel in order to use it as a lever, I believe, to make Julius talk. So it's not like Roy sort of is reflecting on a change in the perception of the case among law enforcement.
Right,
really kind of a lone voice in like, we have to kill this woman. And I mean, this is why, you know, right, she's in Angels of America as sort of his chief tormentor and not he.
Yeah, she's a ghost played by Meryl Streep, who does a very unconvincing Yiddish New York accent in the famous like Ethel Rosenberg coat and hat, tormenting Al Pacino as Roy Cohn as a ghost figure while he's dying of AIDS in the hospital.
You son of a bitch.
The Rosenbergs are executed by electric chair in 1953 at Sing Sing. The electric chair is always a bad way to die, but Ethel Rosenberg's execution in particular seems to have been botched. So they had to shock her over and over and over again in order to get her to die. She had two children, two sons under 10 at the time. And this is, you know, for all the differences they may have had in their approach to the case, Cohn's conduct in the prosecution of the Rosenbergs is really impressive to J. Edgar Hoover, who hires Cohn to come work for him in Washington as sort of a like media fixer. And he's working for J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI for a couple years, essentially working as like a media liaison, right? When J. Edgar Hoover wants to embarrass someone who is not cooperating with him, it is Roy Cohn who he has call up the papers and place this damaging information about them. And this is part of the beginning of Cohn's lifelong vocation, really, like as a blackmail artist, as somebody who can extort favors from people he's targeting by threatening to or actually embarrassing them in the public sphere. And it seems to be J. Edgar Hoover who introduces Roy Cohn to the next major figure in his life, Joe McCarthy. Either of you guys want to tell us about his relationship with Joe McCarthy?
Yeah.
I was going to say, I don't know who should go first. You go first.
So McCarthy, right, senator from the great state of Wisconsin, the last Republican to serve in that job, for some reason, started basically in 1950, more or less, to warn about the presence of communists and homosexuals in, I think initially the State Department, but really it expanded very, very quickly and broadly. And by the time Cohen joins him. He's already a few years into this campaign. Is that right, Matt?
I believe so. I mean, Cohen was 24 when he came to the attention via the Rosenberg trial of J. Edgar Hoover. And yes, by the time he's working for McCarthy, I do think McCarthy had already started getting going on the anti-communist hearings.
And something that's pretty important, that a book that Matt recommended to us and that I loved reading, Christopher Elias's Gossip Men, J. Edgar Hoover, Joe McCarthy, Roy Cohn, and the Politics of Insinuation from University of Chicago Press. Something that it made sense of to me is, like, unlike the Rosenbergs, the question of gossip is sort of central to the McCarthy hearings, right? Like, for listeners who don't know that period so well, McCarthy bursts into the national spotlight in February of 1950 with this famous speech where he claims to have a list of members of the Communist Party employed by the State Department, right? So from the very beginning, this is a politics of gossip. This is really about, like, what did who say to whom?
Well, can I add one little detail here?
Yeah.
The Wheeling, West Virginia speech that Joe McCarthy gave, where he had the supposed list of 200 and some communists. One of the reasons these hearings kind of got started was, you know, like, people didn't take that speech seriously.
Yeah.
And the part about kind of whispers and rumors, I've mentioned this maybe once or twice before, but some of your listeners might know I'm an ex-conservative. When I was 22 years old, I was an intern at the Heritage Foundation for a guy named Lee Edwards, who a few months ago just died. But now that he's passed, I feel more liberated to say, one day we were, as his intern, his research assistant, we were out at the Hoover Institution, not far from all of you, at Stanford, and doing archival research. And one day, driving along the Pacific Ocean, he told me that it was his father, Lee Edwards' father, Willard Edwards, the D.C. bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune, you know, a conservative paper, who gave McCarthy the list.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And by the way, since I mentioned this to Rachel Maddow about a year or so ago, because she's doing a bunch of research into McCarthyism and Red Scare for her, I think, next big podcast project. And she looked into it, and it's true. Like, all of Willard Edwards's columns for the Chicago Tribune were floating these kind of communists infiltrating the federal government around the time of this speech. But that's just to say, in terms of rumors and whispers, yes, it was a list given by a journalist to Joe McCarthy, right, that he used in this speech. And who knows how it had been passed around, you know, until it got to Willard Edwards, who gave it to McCarthy.
Wow.
Yeah.
But that's the origin of the list. A right-wing journalist gave it to Joe McCarthy.
Yeah, it's not like anything we're currently witnessing in this country, so that's great. Yeah, and so Cohen joins this via, as you say, via J. Edgar Hoover. And part of it is that he's just a different person, right? There is an idea that he's still a Democrat, I guess, technically. And at this point, one should say that, like, the famous kind of, like, are you now or have you ever been kind of stuff, I think, is receding into the background. And really, the Lavender Scare is sort of taking over. So here's a gay man, very much in charge of unmasking gay men, mostly within the administrative apparatus of the U.S. government, who people think are basically blackmailable and therefore must be removed.
Uh-huh.
And that's before we even get to Cohn, right? Because, like, right, the other, like, elephant in the room is that, you know, like J. Edgar Hoover, Joe McCarthy is widely rumored to also be a gay man, right? And he has hired this young gay man, Roy Cohn, as an assistant in his, you know, red hunting project and also in his, like, lavender hunting project, right?
Both, yes.
This is a prosecution of gay men led by two allegedly gay men. The irony of this exercise is, like, not exactly lost on people at the time.
I just want to mention, too, that Gore Vidal-Roy Cohn debate we mentioned over Joe McCarthy. It was during that interview that Gore Vidal claimed that Joe McCarthy was a full-time homosexual and that he was told this by none other than Senator from Vermont, Ralph Flanders, who was the one who introduced the censure resolution against McCarthy in the Senate.
Huh.
And I don't like this double standard where we make heroes out of people who have been exposed for support
right,
of communist
let's
causes.
Mr. Vidal,
well, maybe there was a point in making heroes out of the victims of a reckless, gallivanting intriguer. To me, the nicest thing, let's be affirmative, the nicest thing that I ever heard about Joe McCarthy was told me by Senator Flanders of Vermont that he was a full-time homosexual. Is this true?
No, I'm sure you'd think that merited a badge of honor, but it is not true.
Well, I'm getting to you in a minute, but well, I mean, sure. What about Senator McCarthy?
Sure, you. I mean, that's your favorite topic of conversation. I know that.
I know. It's
by the way,
aroused by the obvious.
I know. Just.
And, you know, this detail, Moira, I think you're going to jump on this when I mention it. This isn't like speculation or rumor or gossip, but, you know, Joe McCarthy and his wife, they adopted a baby girl, a daughter. And do you know who helped facilitate the adoption process?
Who?
Cardinal Spellman.
Ah.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Himself an inveterate homosexual who was put into contact with McCarthy by Roy Cohn.
That's crazy.
And that detail of Joe McCarthy probably being gay, put in contact with this gay cardinal of New York, Cardinal Spellman, by another gay guy, Roy Cohn, to adopt a daughter, it was just too much for me to handle almost. Just kind of the depths of absurdity. And as you're getting out, it's McCarthy and Cohn like waging this campaign against both communists and homosexuals.
And, you know, this is the time when Roy meets what will be like the first major man in his life, a guy named G. David Shine, a hotel heir and a kind of like Nordic looking pretty boy. He looks kind of like a Ken doll. Does anybody want to tell me about G. David Shine?
Well, I don't know much about him other than that he is the Jenga piece that brings this entire tower of what Elias calls security state masculinity tumbling down, right? Shine is supposed to be drafted.
As a mere private.
The drafting comes later, right?
Okay,
because Roy Cohn seems to get Shine a job working for Joe McCarthy.
Right.
On a project going around the world to State Department-owned facilities and trying to purge all the communist or subversive books from their libraries, right?
Uh-huh.
So he's got a little crush on this guy. He gets him a job that involves the two of them functionally going on a vacation together.
To Europe.
Largely around Europe.
They're gallivanting around Europe together, yes.
They're like in their mid-20s, and there's accounts of them sort of like running up and down these hotel stairs, like snapping towels at each other's asses.
Uh-huh.
Straight stuff.
Yeah, there's one driver, or a private driver who works for them at the time, who later claims that they're doing gay stuff in the back of his cab.
Mm-hmm.
Shine, it should be said later, goes on to marry a beauty queen and have about 100,000 children. So this does not seem to have been as permanent a part of his life. And people who knew him at the time said that Cohn was sort of more into it than Shine seemed to be.
Uh-huh.
But they were broadly rumored to be dating. And this was, again, not exactly a secret. The quality of Cohn's closet is something I keep returning to, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Because it is more about plausible deniability and the respect imposed by the ability to command deniability than it is about actual concealment of what he's doing.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, not to get ahead of ourselves, but that's such a fascinating comment, Moira, because I kept thinking that to myself. Like, as I was reading about Cohn, watching these documentaries, I think because he did have this kind of oppositional personality, someone who, you know, he did like to challenge, right, the establishment, kind of like take people on. There was almost this, like, daring quality to the flimsiness of Cohn's closet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? And this, I mean, we're talking the 1950s, this Roman holiday with David Shine, this, you know, beautiful, tall, blonde man who kind of did seem to be Cohn's type. I mean, my jaw just dropped, right? Because it did seem like if you wanted to be discreet, as you're persecuting communists and homosexuals, like, if you didn't want this to come back to you in a certain way, you just wouldn't have behaved that way. And it is kind of just a bit shocking how much Cohn almost dared people to call him out, which they did when the fallout from this gallivanting with Shine crashed down upon him.
Yeah.
Adrian, do you want to tell us about that fallout? I interrupted you earlier.
Yeah. Well, let me first also just briefly add that, like, yeah, what Elias calls surveillance state masculinity really is about the operationalization, I guess, of masculinity and media in a really interesting way. So that's the other thing that I wanted to add to what Matt was just saying, which seems exactly right to me. Like, not only is he doing the last thing you kind of want to do if you wanted to stay off the grid, he's doing it on camera. And his downfall, which is identical with the downfall of McCarthy, ultimately, it happens in front of the cameras. You can watch the romance with Shine take the worst possible turn, which is rare for the 1950s on live TV, basically. This is during the Army-McCarthy hearings. And essentially, there is this really amazing exchange where it's, what's his name, Welch, I guess. There's a kind of question about a doctored picture. And Welch asks Jim Juliana, who's a McCarthy assistant, if maybe the photograph came from a pixie. And then I believe McCarthy asks, well, what do you mean by pixie? And Welch replies, well, a pixie is a close relative of a fairy. Does that enlighten you, Senator, right?
And everyone snickers.
I asked him what would happen if Schein got overseas duty. He responded with vigor and force, we'll wreck the army.
I never knew what hung on Schein's
wall. You did know what hung on Schein's wall when that was handed to you, sir. Did you think this came from a pixie?
Counsel, for my benefit, define, I think he might be an expert on that.
Yeah.
Call a pixie.
Yeah. I should say, Mr. Senator, that a pixie is a close relative of a fairy.
Everyone snickers. And the camera, like, I don't know if this is in the original tape or if this is something that people have then done with the tape, but like you kind of feel like the camera sort of zeroing in on Cohn, and you almost think like if this were Arrested Development, you know, like you'd have the Sound of Silence playing and Roy Cohn going, I've made a huge mistake. It just falls apart in this massive way. Uh-huh. And to me, I agree with you that there is this kind of threadbare quality to his closetedness at the time. And here we sort of get the opposite of this. This is what I think Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick calls the epistemology of the closet, right? Like the same gossip that can undo the people that Cohn and McCarthy are ruining can, of course, bounce back on them very easily. That's the wonderful thing about gossip. Mm-hmm. It's hard to control. It goes in every which direction. It gets on you, too, if you spread it, right? And here he is, basically, being called out on, like, wait, why don't you want this Schein guy to be drafted? What's it to ya?
Right. We should probably, like, let our listeners know that the only reason the Army-McCarthy hearings were called is because Roy Cohn had tried to get his boyfriend out of the army.
That's right.
Yes.
He tried to get his boyfriend out of being drafted. The army resisted that imposition, right? They're like, this is actually not really how we do business in the army. They're very self-serious. And Cohn says, well, if you're not going to play ball with me, I'm going to accuse you of having a lot of communist subversives, and I'm going to drag you in front of the Senate subcommittee, for which I am the general counsel, and I'm going to give you the McCarthy treatment. And it's the army playing hardball in response to Cohn's attempt to wheel and deal his own power to get what he wants in terms of, you know, continued sexual access to David Schein, that eventually brings all of Joe McCarthy's career crashing down. That,
yeah.
Have you no decency, sir? At long last, have you no decency? That is a line from the Army-McCarthy hearings, and it's a line that never would have been delivered if Roy Cohn hadn't overstepped his own power.
I hadn't thought with this dick, Riley.
Yes. Yes.
And I mean, to me, that line where like everyone is kind of laughing at this guy and, you know, this guy who has tried to make a victim of the U.S. Army, frankly, like being suddenly the one everyone's pointing and laughing at, right? Like is just so powerful because it shows this kind of razor's edge that this guy walks where he sort of marshals the very same prejudices that would normally undo him, right? And at the same time, it shows that among certain aspects of the security state, in certain parts of conservative politics, there is a real comfort with the closeted gay man as long as he's closeted in the right way. Uh-huh. I tend to think of this as the Lindsey Graham paradox, right? Conservatives love gay men whom they feel they can sort of do with what they want because that gay man is ashamed of who they are and is trying to hide it and thinks he's getting away with it, right? This is the thing that Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick talks about in that book. She's mostly talking about Marcel Proust, about these gay characters that think they're fooling the world, but they're fooling no one. And that's what makes them pliable, what makes them predictable. It's what assigns them a safe place in everyone's cosmos. And people love that about them. They love the fact that this guy thinks, is like, wow, I can't believe I got away with this. And everyone's like, check out that homo over there, right? Like everyone knows, but in some way it's a bad thing to mention it because it in some way destroys the ability to have power over this person. And in the case of the Army-McCarthy hearings, that's kind of a slap on the hand to say like, oh, we do know, by the way. Uh-huh. Do not take our not bringing this up as a kind of cluelessness. We also gossip, you know?
Yes. And I want to add just a couple details here. I mean, what Cohn via McCarthy, you know, what they were asking for David Shine was what's called a direct commission, meaning you're kind of given a commission in the military that's not, that you don't actually have all the qualifications for, right? Or the prerequisites for. So they were kind of asking the Army to give Shine this direct commission. So asking for a favor for him. And as part of the Army-McCarthy hearings, one piece of evidence kind of introduced to sort of justify why perhaps Shine, you know, could have gotten such a commission was this photograph, right, of him with Secretary of the Army, Robert Stevens. And from what everything I know about it, it seems like it really was doctored, like in Stalin-esque fashion, to cut out the other people in the photograph. So it looks like the Secretary of the Army was like, you know, having this one-on-one chat with David Shine. And, well, if he's talking to the Secretary of the Army by himself, of course he might have gotten this commission, right? But it turns out that was doctored. And like, this is what Roy Cohn's like.
Yeah, it's so brazen, right? And it's also so campy. I mean, this is why Kushner is clearly attracted to this. That's why, mm-hmm. I mean, many gay actors have attempted that role since and have done it very, very well, right? That's why Al Pacino loves it. It's like, I mean, this is just like the kind of scenery chewing that you get out of Scarface and Roy Cohn. That's it. End of list.
Yes.
So at this point, you might be saying to yourself, wait, In Bed with the Right finally got to one of its white whales, Mr. Roy Cohn, and it got the amazing Matt Sipman to sit down with them and talk to them about Roy Cohn, and they think they're going to be done with this in one episode. Well, you were faster than we were. This is one of the granddaddies. This is one of the people we really have been wanting to delve into for quite some time. And so we're going to make this a two-parter. It gives us enough time to really dwell on the back end of Roy Cohn's checkered and horrible career. You know, if you thought you've met some of the worst people of the 20th century in this episode, you're going to meet some of the worst people of the 21st century. So expect the next episode from us in a week's time. We thank you for your forbearance. Stay tuned for the second part of our deep dive into the life and times of Mr. Roy Cohn. In Bed with the Right is made possible by hundreds of listeners who support us via Patreon.com. Our episodes are produced and edited by Mark Yoshizumi and Katie Lau. Our title music is by Katie Lau.